Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Robert Yeager and the Tau Foundation.
This week on The Wheelhouse. MAGA politics. And a little later, Taylor Swift and 2024. For Connecticut Public, I'm Frankie Graziano. This is The Wheelhouse, the show that connects the politics of the people. We got your weekly dose of politics in Connecticut and beyond, right here. Later this hour, we're going to get into Taylor Swift's influence, not only in our culture, but our politics too. But first, make America great again. That was everywhere in the run-up to the 2016 presidential election. That slogan became the rallying cry of former President Donald Trump and his supporters. It was shouted out on the campaign trail. It was on banners. It was even on hats. Remember those red hats? Since Trump's election, the slogan has become more than just a slogan. It's now a political movement, a style of politics. So what is the state of MAGA politics today, and is it going to resonate with voters in 2024? With me now are two of the biggest names in political journalism. I am so lucky to have them both on. First, Maya King, politics reporter of the New York Times. Good morning, Maya.
Good morning.
Very nice to have you on. Thank you for coming back on The Wheelhouse. And then Amy Walter, publisher and editor-in-chief, The Cook Political Report. Amy, thank you so much for coming on today.
Yeah, happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on. And folks, if you're listening, we want to know, do you think MAGA politics are still effective? Or I guess effective in drumming up support for an agenda? You can join the conversation. 888-720-9677. 888-720-9677. Maya, the slogan, Make America Great Again. Pretty loaded, right? What's the general sentiment behind it?
Well, I mean, this has become the slogan that Trump and his followers have used to sort of describe their own political movement. I think you can also use the phrase America First to also encapsulate kind of how what they're feeling. But I mean, it harkens back, I think, in the minds of Trump and of his followers to a brighter and better moment in the country, but that is defined very differently for different Americans. I think the way that it's described now is more or less about, you know, what you might idealize in politics and more what you do, this sort of brand of far-right policies, but also zero-sum politics, this idea that anything that Democrats gain is a loss for Republicans or for Team Red versus Team Blue. And sort of this idea of colloquially owning the libs and doing anything that you can to make it seem like, you know, to make your politics, I think, for Republicans, to make it seem like they are doing something to the detriment of Democrats. And that doesn't always necessarily correlate to real policy. But that, I think, is the rallying cry among many in the MAGA or America First movement.
So what you're getting at is MAGAs have become more than just a slogan, maybe a style of politics. What defines MAGA style politics or Trumpism?
Well, it looks different in different ways. I think the way that you see it right now on the campaign trail, Trump is not as active on the campaign trail as he was in 2016 and 2020. But it is the same sort of rallying cry against Democrats' leadership in the country, this feeling that President Biden has weaponized the government against Republicans, against President Trump. I think in Congress, the way that we've seen it with the beginnings of these impeachment inquiries against President Biden, all of these actions are part of the broader MAGA far-right movement among Republicans, and particularly among base Republicans and presidential primary voters on the right.
Any kind of characteristics that might make somebody MAGA?
I mean, I think it's a number of different things. It's this idea that anything that Democrats do is to your detriment. Being very vocal against, I think, Democratic politics, against President Biden. Of course, unabashed allegiance to former President Trump. That's probably the first thing that makes a MAGA or America First voter. And an allegiance to far-right ideology. I think that's really how we see the MAGA movement take place now.
What about a litmus test for whether or not you qualify as MAGA? We're getting really into this. I kind of like how deep we're going into this.
Yeah, I mean, I would allude to Amy on this. I think she's written and spoken about this quite a bit. The first thing that comes to mind, though, for me is what we saw in Congress just a few weeks ago. Kevin McCarthy, the former Speaker of the House, was a very close ally of President Trump. But, you know, in trying to stop a government shutdown, actually, sided or tried to vote with Democrats or get the support of Democrats. And that immediately drew the ire of a number of far right Republican congressmen and women who said that was a bridge too far for them, and that Republicans in Congress should not at all do anything bipartisan or work with Democrats. And then he was subsequently removed from office. That to me presented like a litmus test for one, your allegiance to former President Trump, who had already said very vocally that he did not want to see McCarthy or Republicans in Congress vote with Democrats, but also just the actions of many Republicans who say if you do anything to work with the opposing party or any policies that the far right or Republicans do not support, then you are not adequately loyal to the party. You're not an America First Republican. And he was subsequently removed from that post. And I think that was one, you know, very clear example, not necessarily in presidential politics, but certainly on the national stage.
Sorry, the way you've outlined that, it sounds like a high school kind of situation. Like you're not America First. You're not with us. You can't wear the red hat. You can't sit with us at the lunch table.
Well, that is kind of what we're hearing from a number of Republicans, and I hear it from Republican voters that the people who they want to support, not just President Trump, but Republican candidates down ballot, what they like a lot about the Republicans that they plan to vote for is their aversion, frankly, to bipartisanship. You know, he votes with us. He's with us. These are the kinds of phrases that I hear from Republican-based primary voters, from longtime Trump supporters. This idea that they want to vote for a Republican who they feel or who at least presents as if he is only going to or she only going to vote or support the policies that President Trump, former President Trump, has rubber stamped and that they are going to follow and throw their support behind a Republican, a conservative who has unabashedly said, I do not support anything that Democrats are doing, and fully embracing all of the far right policies, whether that's on foreign policy or, even more localized issues like school board issues. These are all the things I think that are part of the MAGA America First movement, that there's not necessarily a written list or a litmus test. But I think that these candidates know if they say the right things and speak to the right policies, and then, of course, say that they embrace Trump and that they believe that President Biden is unfairly weaponizing the government against him. Like, I think all of these things contribute to what makes an America First candidate and what garners his support from the base.
Amy Walter, publisher and editor-in-chief, The Cook Political Report. I want to just go back a little bit and talk about political party sort of realignments in history. Is there one, though, that makes this kind of different, what's happening now with the Republican Party, maybe MAGA-ism, if that's an ism? What do you think?
You know, what's really interesting about where we are at this point is that it feels like it came upon us suddenly, the MAGA or America First piece of Trumpism. But the trend lines have been there for a while now. The party of the Republican Party.
Yes.
I remember back when I first started covering politics, a state like Connecticut had a congressional delegation that was, if not majority Republican, at least half and half Republican. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, there aren't any Republicans left in the Connecticut delegation. Meanwhile, in places like Mississippi and even Alabama, you had significant number of Democrats, right? So you had a realignment happening over the last 30 or 40 years. Some of it was regional. So the old lines of the really post-Civil War era were starting now to be rearranged, that the Northern Republican states now becoming more Democratic and the Southern Democratic states becoming more Republican. A lot of it was driven by cultural and social issues, and, you know, seeing a Democratic Party that was defined really by a more diverse electorate. One, obviously, after the civil rights era, was now the party of voters of color. And as such, what you saw was a real retrenchment, especially among white voters, and moving over to the Republican Party from their ancestral home. So this had been happening for a while. And then you throw issues like guns and abortion and gay marriage and education, a whole bunch of other issues that started to really push the two parties in different directions, with Republicans going much more in a conservative direction on all of those issues, Democrats a more liberal direction. So it's been happening for a while. Donald Trump came into this moment and basically supercharged it. I like how Maya described it as really a moment where there were at zero sum politics. That, yes, there's always been disagreement. Yes, we've always had fights between the parties about the direction. Yes, we've always had breakdowns when it comes to, you know, who's going to compromise and which party is going to be able to claim victory versus be gracious in defeat. But what the MAGA movement, what Trump did, was to basically say that anything that is less than pure 100% victory is basically defeat. There's no such thing as real compromise on this issue. But what we're also seeing that's different from Trump, and quite frankly, it'll be fascinating to see what happens to the party post-Trump, but moving the Republican Party in a more populist, nationalist way than traditional Republicans, many of whom are still uncomfortable are seeing. So you're moving...
Yeah, and did you see that, Amy, in what I just asked about Maya with the litmus test? She brought up a terrific example of whether or not we go with Kevin McCarthy. We ultimately saw what happened with Mike Johnson, but help me there with that litmus test and how Republicans felt there. It sounds like maybe a little uncomfortable.
Well, think about an issue like Ukraine. Think about the issues surrounding just foreign policy in general. The party of Reagan, the party that was once about, you know, you need to peace through strength. America's role in the world is really one to stand up for freedoms everywhere and to basically stand up to bullies and to autocrats like Putin or like Xi or like Hamas, right? That's what America does. What Trumpism is saying is, no, that's not where America needs to be. America needs to focus back at home. And that Republican, going back, as I said, Reagan, Bush, all of whom were adherents to that style of foreign policy intervention are no longer welcomed in the party. And on fiscal issues, think about Mitt Romney, and it wasn't that long ago, Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan running on a platform that suggested, you know, we need to make real serious changes to the social safety net on things like Medicare and Social Security. George W. Bush talked about privatizing Social Security. That's not where Republicans are now. This is a party that is very comfortable saying, nope, we are the party that will protect more government spending on those things. Now we're going to cut them on other things, but on the really the main drivers of government spending, Medicare, Social Security, they are bigger defenders than they were, again, just 20, 30, 40 years ago.
I just want to throw some context in here on how maybe local lawmakers dealing with some of this on the home front here. So I'm going to go to line one here as we have a call from State Representative Christine Palm. Go ahead, throw this context in here. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. I just want to thank your guest for bringing this up, but I'd like, as a state politician, I'd like to go a little deeper into what those policies translate into, and I am going to use some isms here, but...
rather briefly, if you can. Thank you.
They are homophobic, misogynistic, anti-trans, anti-immigrant, anti-environment, and most of those talking points come from ALEC, the Republican, quote-unquote, you know, policy think tank. So let's call it what it is. They are anti-civil rights, not just anti-Democrat, but anti-democratic.
Thank you so much, State Representative Christine Palm. And I think it's kind of getting to the battle lines kind of being drawn beforehand, as you had mentioned, in a different way, obviously, Amy. But, you know, gay marriage, abortion, as you mentioned, reproductive rights, kind of, pushing these folks that are MAGA style politicians. Maybe they're digging their heels in after that, something like that. I think that's what Christine Palm might be speaking to.
Yeah. Ron Brownstein, who is a fantastic journalist, CNN analyst, writes for The Atlantic. His take on this is you have one party that is sort of more future oriented. Think about which is the Democratic Party, about where we're headed, a multicultural, multi-ethnic America, and one party that would like us to is more afraid of that version of America, right? Likes the version of America that was in place in the 50s and in the 60s, that the future that they're seeing right now, that many of these MAGA folks are seeing, whether it's on issues around sexuality, gender identity, or whether it is on, again, a true multicultural democracy, those sorts of things are the ones that they don't feel comfortable in that version of America. And that's what the fight essentially is, you know, centering around right now. What version of America do we want to see? And what's the real version of America? I mean, that's why this fight, it feels different from, say, fights we had in the 80s over, you know, what's the role of government and how much should we be paying in taxes? This is a fight over really and truly what is it, what does it mean to be an American? Who is an American? What are American values? And the two sides are about as far apart on what those things are than certainly I've ever seen in my lifetime.
Maya, how effective would you say MAGA style politics are today? Has there been a shift since Donald Trump first entered the political scene?
Well, no, but I think it's actually just only become more pronounced. And I want to underline exactly what Amy just said about the difference between Democrats and Republicans in terms of looking towards the future versus looking towards the past. That encapsulates exactly what MAGA means. Making America great again is sort of an allusion to going back to the past. And that means different things for different Americans, particularly white Americans versus Americans of color. I think going back for a number of Americans of color, Black and Latino Americans, is not really quite the ideal America that they would want to see. And I think that's where, you know, that's where the tension, in my view, becomes even more heightened. And that's what I think we're going to see become more clear in 2024. Democrats have not quite leaned fully in. I think we're seeing it more into the stakes of just what a return to a Trump presidency or what a MAGA America might look like. I think we're starting to see President Biden kind of lay out those stakes more clearly as they relate to democratic norms. But as we get closer to the presidential election to next November, I think these are the exact conversations that Democrats and their surrogates are going to start having, which is this idea of going back, or of Democrats who are looking forward, not just on racial policy, but also on, you know, things like climate change and the existence of climate change in the environment. You know, the safety and the protections on public school education. I mean, that's another really huge issue. And all of these kind of tie into, I think, the stark differences that you see between MAGA Republicans and Democrats.
Amy, does the effectiveness of MAGA politics or Trumpism or America First depend on whether candidates are running in primaries versus general elections? I got to also wonder if the effectiveness of MAGA politics depends on the state. So like red or blue, purple, even?
Right. So what we're seeing is in red states, you can run as a pro-Trump, MAGA type Republican in a primary and in a general election. Both of those, you will be successful in both places. The challenge for many of these candidates, though, is in purple states or obviously in blue states. We saw this in 2022. Many, if not most, of the candidates that ran as sort of Trump-style politicians, those who got Trump's endorsement in places like Pennsylvania and Arizona, found themselves on the losing end of the on election day, in part because those states are more evenly divided between blue and red. And at the end of the day, there were just more voters who don't want to see that style of politics than those who do. The challenge in a state like Connecticut or other blue states, if you are a Republican who isn't trying to run under the Trump banner, is that it is almost impossible for you to win a primary. The easiest way to win a primary right now as a Republican is to run as a Trump endorsed or a Trump supporter. The harder thing to do is to sort of balance, right? How do you win a primary in a blue state, but be win a Republican primary in a blue state, but be seen in a general election as not too far into the Trump or MAGA movement.
We're about to go to break and we'll pick this conversation up after it. But first, I got to take care of some Wheelhouse related business. We're doing another Wheelhouse later today. But instead of listening to it live on the radio, you can watch it all go down in person live in Hartford. You can meet the Wheelhouse team tonight at 5:30 inside of our Connecticut Public Studios. And there's only two tickets left. Two tickets left. That's how popular the show is. So thank you so much for all of your support. Powerhouse panel recapping the year of politics, offering a quick look into what's in store for 2024, and you'll get a surprise guest. Only two tickets left. ctpublic.org/Frankie, ctpublic.org/FRANKIE. From Connecticut Public Radio, this is The Wheelhouse. I'm Frankie Graziano. More on MAGA politics next.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. Hartford HealthCare recently celebrated the opening of the Ridge Recovery Center in Windham. Christy Scott, Vice President of Clinical Operations, describes this new state-of-the-art destination for healing.
Individuals will come if they're suffering from substance use disorder and get individualized treatment. They can stay up to 3 to 4 weeks and receive family therapy, individual therapy, group therapy, and lots of other holistic care like yoga, trail walking, acupuncture. So it's going to be a great place for people to come and heal.
For those seeking recovery, finding it close to home can sometimes be challenging.
Many individuals travel to Florida and other states that have more treatment centers, so we're hoping by doubling our capacity at Hartford HealthCare, the individuals can stay in their home state with their family and support systems close by.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
This is The Wheelhouse from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Frankie Graziano. We've been talking about MAGA-style politics inspired by former President Donald Trump and whether or not it's still resonating with voters. With me are Maya King, politics reporter, New York Times, and Amy Walter, publisher and editor-in-chief of the Cook Political Report. Join this conversation if you'd like, 888-720-9677, 888-720-9677. Amy, the nationalization of our politics, how much has that informed what we're talking about this hour?
That's an excellent point. And I think that our parties are now more homogenous than they've ever been. Wasn't that long ago, as I talked about earlier, that there were more conservative Southern Democrats and more liberal Northeastern Republicans. All of those types of members have been replaced. There really is not much difference now between the most liberal member of a party and the most conservative member of that party. And what that means when you have two really homogenous parties, it really is challenging then to make much change within your own party, right? So you kind of have to go with where the majority is at that moment. Breaking out is very, very hard to do. And it's why it's very hard to win, as I said, as a Republican who would be a better fit, let's say, in Connecticut, right? There's a certain type of Republicanism that is attractive in New England and in parts of the Northeast, but it's not the kind of Republicanism that would win you a primary, even in those blue states, but would win you a general election in those places.
Maya, do we know about how MAGA candidates fare, depending on whether or not they're running in local or national races?
Well, it depends. I mean, I think I'll speak for Georgia, where I'm based. MAGA candidates who are aligned with former President Trump tend to fare very well in primary elections, and with a few notable exceptions, of course. I would say that the Senate candidacy of Herschel Walker was not a success in any real way, though he was closely aligned with President Trump. But, you know, in a general election, he still did have quite a bit of overwhelming support from Republicans. But I think also, you know, Georgia might be an example of what happens in a purple state, because you have folks like Brian Kemp, who are not MAGA aligned, the governor of Georgia, but actually was able to succeed on a message of being of not necessarily being aligned with the former president, but still supporting some of his policies. Now, further down the ballot, I think, you know, it's important that we did hear from a state house representative, because state house policies are a little closer to the ground. And they are the folks who are, I think, largely making the policies that might trickle up to international politics. And that's where I've seen a number of far right candidates, particularly in deeper red corners of a purple state, still really be able to be successful in their own regard through their alignment with former President Trump.
Amy, how are conservative politicians thinking and talk about MAGA style politics? I'm thinking especially about the candidates that are running for president.
So what we're seeing in the race for president is that while many, I would say like in the establishment class, the donor class, the more elite levels of the Republican establishment, they would like to see someone not named Donald Trump as the nominee. But that's not where voters are. Republican voters, very happy with Donald Trump and would like to see him continue to be the nominee. So every candidate who's running, the only of the candidates who are still in the race now, only one of them, Chris Christie, is running as essentially an anti-MAGA candidate, an anti-Trump candidate. And as you can see, he's getting zero traction. And he's the most unpopular Republican in the field right now. And the other three who are left are essentially running it as different shades of Trumpism, whether some even more Trumpy or MAGA-y than Donald Trump himself. So it's that fine line, and that Maya talked about, that someone like Brian Kemp is able to walk, of saying, I may support many of these policies, but the more controversial pieces of Trumpism, especially things like election denialism, they are rejecting.
Maya, just lastly here in the last minute or so that we have this conversation, I want to talk about the big question that I have for you. Can the Republican Party wrestle the party away from Trump's grip anytime soon? Is that not likely? What do you think?
Well, that's a lot to answer in a minute.
But a loaded question. Give me your best shot.
I mean, if things continue on the trend that they're on today, it's very unlikely that the party will be able to wrestle, you know, itself away from Trump's grip. He's not only, you know, the unequivocal leader right now in terms of his dominance over the primary, but he also has been able to, in many ways, control how debates are run. He's not, you know, attending any of them, and the RNC has tried to work around him. I think that's a huge story that we'll see in terms of party infrastructure next year. And Republican-based voters still are basing their opinions of other candidates, their thoughts on policy, their thoughts on national politics around what the former president says, what he opines on, and what they feel is most closely aligned with him. You know, we'll see if there's any real shift. I think his being on trial could possibly change the way some conservative voters think about Republican politics and his role as a leader of the party. But for now, today, in this iteration of things, it seems very unlikely that Trump is on any sort of downward spiral, downward sliding among Republicans.
Maya King, outstanding politics reporter at the New York Times. So grateful to have her on the Wheelhouse again. Thank you for coming on today, Maya.
Oh, thanks for having me, Frankie.
And then the publisher and editor-in-chief of the great Cook Political Report, Amy Walter, thank you so much for coming on today.
Sure thing, Frankie.
We're going to take a break, but after that, we're going to talk about Taylor Swift and politics. Give us a call, 888-720-9677.
You're listening to the new investigative reporting podcast, In Absentia, which means you're interested in getting to the facts and uncovering the truth. If you'd like to help us continue our investigative work, consider making a donation. Visit ctpublic.org/tapsupport and contribute today. That's ctpublic.org/tapsupport. Thank you for being a part of the Accountability Project.
If you've never donated to the station before, that's okay. Public radio is available to everyone for free. But we do rely on listener support from those who are able to give. So join the community of supporters for Public Media Giving Days. And thanks.
Give now at ctpublic.org/donate.
This is The Wheelhouse from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Frankie Graziano. We gotta shake off the MAGA politics and talk about somebody we know all too well. Yeah, there's music.
Oh, wow. Your girlfriend, she's upset. She's going off about something that you said. She doesn't get your humor like I do.
There's 70 seconds of this. Let's go. Probably wondering why we're vibing and talking about Taylor Swift on a politics show, right? Ah, well, turns out she's got a lot of sway, not just in our culture, but our political landscape too. She's got a reputation, if you will. Heck, just named, breaking news, Times Person of the Year. And even further, can you actually pull that up? Can you actually pull that up? Let's get in there. Yeah. Enjoy that. Ah, yeah. In September, Swift took to Instagram and urged her fans to register to vote. Vote.org reported a surge of 35,000 registrations after her post. Not only that, but the pop singer has had a political awakening in recent years. She's gone from being largely silent on political issues to being outspoken on everything from her support for LGBTQ plus rights to her endorsement of Joe Biden in 2020. So how much of an impact could she have in 2024? Is this her era? Are you ready for it? Are you ready for it? With us is someone who studies the intersection of politics and pop culture, Jeffrey Dudas, the professor of political science at the University of Connecticut and co-host of the UConn Popcast. Thank you for coming in today.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
We just went from talking about MAGA-style politics. You can't do the abortion. You have no reproductive rights. No gay rights. Nothing like that. To we're just having some fun with Taylor Swift. What a change. And you just authored that change.
Well, I am ready for it.
So. Yes, you are, because you made the pun. Hey, do you think Taylor Swift can impact our politics? You could join the conversation. Hey, if you do it quickly, you could even call in and just sing a Taylor Swift lyric. Don't even ask us a question. You can even call in and sing if you want. All right, let me get to business here. A recent NBC News political style poll showed Taylor Swift had a 40% favorability rating. Beyonce, big one, too. Just how popular is Taylor Swift today?
She's unprecedentedly popular, it seems to me. Not only does she not have a contemporary analog, Beyonce probably the closest thing, but it's not clear to me either that Taylor has a historical precedent for this kind of sustained popularity. It's one thing to be popular for a year or two for a particular celebrity cycle. It's another thing entirely, it seems to me, to be consistently, in fact, growingly popular over the course of 15 years. For that, I don't think we have a historical antecedent.
I got to jump in there because Madonna, right? I had the same conversation with my wife. This is great that you're bringing this up. Michael Jackson.
Yep.
This is just my lifetime. But before that, I don't know about this. Beatles. Elvis, the Beatles.
Yep.
You're saying Taylor Swift may be bigger.
She doesn't have the kinds of dips and cycles in popularity that all of those previously mentioned artists had. We now think about Elvis or we think about the Beatles, for example, as these kind of dominating presences over the course of multiple decades. But in point of fact, the span during which they were at the top of the popularity world was quite short. The Beatles, it's about 6 or 7 years. For Elvis, it's actually quite less than that. And, you know, people forget that Elvis went off to the army and was in the movies for quite a while. And that really took a major hit out of his popularity. And so these folks had waves of popularity. The same with Madonna, the same with Michael Jackson. They had waves. They had dips, peaks and valleys. Taylor has not had those kinds of things. She has just been growingly popular, exponentially popular with every era, so to speak.
Love that. I don't think I've been thinking about this big enough. So not Elvis, not the Beatles. Maybe more, sorry for the blasphemy, maybe Gandhi, Jesus Christ, in that realm, we got to start thinking about Taylor Swift.
Well, maybe the cart's in front of the horse there.
But she's really popular. But how much influence does Swift have on everything under the sun, including politics?
I think she certainly has much more influence in the popular culture world and certainly in the world of celebrity culture than she does in the world of politics. And I don't mean to gainsay her sort of beginning political efforts in terms of the voting drive and occasionally making endorsements as she made in the 2018 Tennessee senatorial race. But one of the indications that you know that she has not really moved fully into the world of politics is that exact poll that you were talking about from last week. The fact that she is considerably more popular than either of the presumptive major party nominees for the presidential race in 2024 indicates that she has not been kind of put into the same sort of partisan category that a lot of public figures end up being into. If you were to dig into the crosstabs of that poll, what you'd find is, maybe surprisingly, there isn't a real big partisan gap in her approval rating between Republicans and Democrats. There's a little bit of one, but not what you might expect given the sort of efforts on the part of conservative media to paint her most recently as a kind of progressive Democratic warrior.
And there is, though, with Beyonce, though. That's problematic. I don't think we have time to get into that, though. But there is a little bit more with Beyonce. And maybe that has something else to do with it. But a question I always hear now, because I want to talk about the bigger world that Taylor Swift now envelops, just outside of politics, too. But question I always hear is, how's Travis Kelce going to play on Sunday? I don't know. Is Taylor going to be there? So hasn't the NFL also kind of gotten this major bump now that she started dating Travis?
You know, the NFL is in the business of getting more people rather than fewer people to watch their product. And so they are very thrilled, I'm quite sure, with the current state of affairs. They love the fact that they can put Taylor on screen for, you know, after every touchdown or just, you know, when it gets boring, you can put her on screen. I do think it brings her to a slightly different demographic, maybe the last demographic that she hadn't quite yet enveloped herself with. And so that's good for her, and it's definitely good for the NFL.
You're saying that Roger Goodell's wearing one of those Travis Kelce-style denim suits.
I think NFL fans would tell you that anytime the focus is not on Roger Goodell, that's good news.
All right, we're going to play a clip from Swift's documentary, Miss Americana. She's speaking about something you alluded to earlier, U.S. Senator Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee.
It really is a big deal. She votes against fair pay for women. She votes against the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act, which is just basically protecting us from domestic abuse and stalking. She thinks that if you're a gay couple, or even if you look like a gay couple, you should be allowed to be kicked out of a restaurant. It's really basic human rights, and it's right and wrong at this point. And I can't see another commercial and see her disguising these policies behind the words Tennessee Christian values. Those aren't Tennessee Christian values. I live in Tennessee. I am Christian. That's not what we stand for.
Very emotional Taylor Swift there in Miss Americana on Netflix. Tell us about her political evolution, because she wasn't always outspoken on politics, right?
For sure. You know, the thing to remember about Taylor's trajectory as an artist is that she really does come out of the Nashville music factory. And she comes out of the Nashville Music Factory at a very particular moment in music history, the early 21st century. And at that time, the kinds of hits that are being spawned out of Nashville are these kind of pop country hits. And the most important of the artists who are finding success at that time are the Dixie Chicks. And what happens to the Dixie Chicks is kind of imprinted in Taylor's memory and her emotional life as she's trying to navigate this landscape. And when they come out with, really, in retrospect, what's pretty mild criticism of the Iraq War and pretty mild criticism of George W. Bush, by the way, in England, not even in the United States, their career, the Dixie Chicks' career, was really, you know, harmed materially. There was a massive backlash, and Taylor Swift is a huge Dixie Chicks fan, and so she's seeing this. And so what she's getting out of this as a young person is that there's nothing but danger to be found in stepping into the arena of politics or stepping into saying anything that has anything whatever to do about larger social or cultural issues. And so she's quite reticent, and she's famously reticent for a long time about offering any kind of, about putting her voice into public conversations. And, you know, part of what happens is that she steps out of the pop country world and she becomes more of a pop artist, where the kinds of constraints that limit the voices of artists are not quite as robust. They're more permeable. It's easier to speak on public issues and to face much less of a backlash or potential backlash than they might otherwise. And the other thing that's happening, of course, is that she's getting older and she's maturing and she's becoming more confident in her vision of what it means to be a successful person in this country. And she's really starting to lean into questions of ownership and authority over her own music and the ability to kind of to determine for herself how her career will go. And I think there's this confluence of things that are all hitting at once, and it makes it so that the environment changes for her to feel a lot more comfortable in, you know, expressing her opinions and beginning to encourage people to see the world as she sees it and to encourage them to get engaged in participatory politics.
If you didn't think we can have a thoughtful conversation about Taylor Swift and politics, ha ha, we got you. Jeffrey Dudas is just crushing it, and I appreciate the tone of your voice there. I just want to call back to something that Amy Walter said earlier, because you were talking about the Dixie Chicks, or the Chicks as it is now, but it's always been there. We were talking about MAGA-style politics, make America great again, the rhetoric. It's always been there, and you saw it. That's an example of what Amy's talking about, where 20 years ago, something like that, you can't even have mild criticism of the president.
Well, it's not just that you couldn't have mild criticism of the president. Everything that was critical of the war effort in particular. I mean, the Dixie Chicks come out, and when they are offering this critique, it's right in the heart of, it's right at the beginning of the Iraq War.
Yeah,
and
people are sending their kids off to war, too. That's the emotional heartstrings
exactly.
that people are playing on.
Exactly, yeah. And there's this very strong rally around the flag sort of effect at the time, and criticism or critique of any form at that time was looked upon very unkindly.
A lot of attention in Congress lately on Ticketmaster, especially after the recent Taylor Swift ticketing fiasco. So we look to Taylor on everything. We look to Bruce Springsteen on a lot of things, too. We look to Beyonce on a lot. We treat our celebrities as if they are godlike a lot of the time. So how much influence do artists like Taylor actually have, not just on our politics, but on specific policies on this, like maybe getting Ticketmaster to lower prices, something like that?
I think the influence there, history would suggest, is quite limited indeed. And the analog there would be Pearl Jam's efforts in the mid-1990s to take on the Ticketmaster monopoly. And they famously refused to play in venues that were operated by Ticketmaster, that had meaningful contractual engagement with Ticketmaster. And this was at the height of Pearl Jam's popularity. This was they were the band at the time. This is just after Kurt Cobain had committed suicide. So Pearl Jam steps into this void. They are at the top of the charts. If there were ever a band that would have been able to have a meaningful effect upon Ticketmaster and other,
this is right after Versus came out.
Exactly.
Pearl Jam
it's during that tour, and they found very few places where they could play. The tour itself was kind of a fiasco from an organizational perspective because they simply didn't have a competitor in terms of Ticketmaster that they could organize around. And it was a broad failure, and no other big artists at the time joined them in this effort. Now, Taylor is, as I say, historically unprecedented in terms of her popularity, and so Pearl Jam is not a particularly good analog. However, I don't imagine that Taylor would have the kind of influence on the big business elements of ticketing and concert promotion that that would be necessary to drive major change.
I'm going to try to get to these next two questions in 2 minutes because we don't have a lot of time. We got a lot of excitement in the MAGA-style politics episode. We had to play some Taylor Swift music. We got to hear Taylor Swift. So there's been some Republican backlash to Swift's politics. Do Swift and her fans need to tell them, you need to calm down? What do you think?
Perhaps. Taylor has no shortage of defenders amongst her fans. I'm not worried about her being put through a crucible of public opinion in which she's not able to fight back.
That's a very nice way to put it. Just about a minute left here or so. I'm just wondering, as we kind of finish up here, is there a responsibility of celebrity to weigh in on politics? And as you said, while they may have defenders, do they risk a lot by doing it? May they lose some of their defenders? What do you think?
Sometimes, yes. I think it probably depends upon the issue. I think it depends upon the level of celebrity influence of the person that we're talking about.
Could Taylor be untouchable? Is that where you're getting to?
Maybe. Yeah. Maybe.
Wow.
I also wonder, and I understand our time limits here, I do wonder about our felt need.
30 seconds. You got time to take it.
I wonder about our felt need as an audience to hear from celebrities about stuff that they're not famous for. Taylor gives us everything that we could ever hope for in her creations, in her songs. And I wonder what it says about us as a community that we have some felt need to have our celebrities weigh in on issues that they may well know nothing about.
Do you want me to go look in the mirror while we're doing this? Jeffrey Dudas is just spectacular. We got to end the conversation here, but wow, very thoughtful. This is why you do what you do. And thank you for being our resident Swiftie. We appreciate it.
I loved being here. Thanks for having me.
Great show today, produced by Meg Dalton. What a show she put together. And we actually have one more show that we got to work on tonight in Hartford in front of a live audience. That's right. It's the Wheelhouse Live. And there's only two tickets left. Myself, a powerhouse panel. We look back at the year in politics and ahead to 2024, plus a surprise guest. And maybe we'll throw some hand-signed ollies out there. It's going to be a lot of fun. Light refreshments. Don't miss it. Buy a ticket for $8 at ctpublic.org/Frankie. I didn't come up with this vanity title, but it's a good one. That's ctpublic.org/FRANKIE. Technical producer for today's show is Kat Pastor. Thank you so much, Katie Talarski, helping us in studio, giving me some battery for my laptop. Download the Wheelhouse anytime on your favorite podcast app. I'm Frankie Graziano. This is The Wheelhouse. Thank you for listening.